Overall, give us an overall impression, first of all. Are primary schools working?
Yes, primary schools are working very definitely. And they're working very hard too. It's our judgment, looking at across all our evidence, and I won't go into all the detail, that primary schools are under pressure because of 20 years of non-stop reform. But they are, as we say, in good heart, highly valued by the communities, highly valued by parents and children, giving children a point of stability in a world which is changing and uncertain, and a clear framework of values to work in. They are performing well in terms of the quality of learning. Now, there are questions about standards, there are questions about the unevenness of the provision. There is clearly room for improvement. In a large, complex system like ours, in a complex country, it couldn't be otherwise. But the general picture is a good one. And we would want to argue very strongly against anyone who says that our primary schools aren't working.
You've called for the scrapping of SAT tests. Why is that?
We don't think they're fit for purpose, to use that familiar phrase. We are arguing that children have an entitlement to a broad, rich curriculum which covers far more than the SATs cover. And it's not right, we think, to assume that testing in the SATs will give a fix on pupils' learning overall. It doesn't. You can't treat them as a proxy. In addition, there are questions about adverse impacts of the SATs on the rest of the curriculum and, indeed, on children and teachers. And the select committee before us, the Common Select Committee chaired by Barry Shearman, came up with a very critical report on the current system. And putting that together with the evidence from the Assessment Reform Group, all the other groups who've reported to us, it's clear that we need an alternative. We are arguing not for the abolition of assessment, but for a new system of assessment. And I'd want to stress very strongly that we're not saying that children shouldn't be assessed or schools shouldn't be accountable. We're saying that they should be assessed and they should be accountable. You know, these things matter. But the question is how they should be assessed and how schools should be made accountable. And we want a system of assessment which fairly reflects the full range of learning which children pursue. We think children are entitled to a broad, rich curriculum. Therefore, the assessment should cover that. And an assessment system which is not so intrusive or high stakes that it actually distorts the very thing it is supposed to measure.
You've raised questions about the system of having one teacher teaching a class, something that's been in place for more than 100 years. Could you tell us a bit more about that and what you think could go in its place?
Yes. We've called for a full staffing review. The work of primary schools has expanded enormously since the class teacher system was brought in the 19th century. And it's brought in not for educational reasons, but simply because it was the cheapest way to do it. And since then, that's the basis on which primary schools have been both staffed and critically funded. We want a full staffing review which sets out the range of tasks in the curriculum, in the classroom, outside the classroom, within the community that schools have to do, and asks whether schools have the kinds of expertise and the numbers to fulfil those tasks. If they don't, then we need to look again at the way that schools are staffed. And we think in all probability it will be found that many schools do not have what they need in order to do what is required of them. One of the areas of concern would be the sheer range and complexity of a modern curriculum compared with a curriculum which, as it was, say, at the end of the 19th century. And this asks a lot of one person in terms of their command of the subject knowledge, particularly with older children. And this has been debated over the last 20 or 30 years, and we would like schools to be in a position, should they need to do so, to use generalists or semi-specialists or specialists. But at the moment, staffing doesn't allow that. And we would like staffing to be freed up so that schools do have specialist expertise available across the curriculum and can deploy it, not just to support teachers who lack confidence, but also in some cases to go in and actually do specialist teaching.
Specialist teaching would cost more money.
Yep. Specialist teaching would cost more money, and at the present time there is no money. We are arguing that as one source, which is not that modest, that the trend towards greater and greater centralisation and central prescription and micromanagement should be reversed, and therefore that there should be a reduction in national infrastructure. The national strategies should be wound up. And that the savings from reducing national infrastructure, which would mean, you know, the number of people working in the central agencies, should be funneled down to schools. But it could be argued that even that's not going to generate the funding which is necessary for improving the depth and range of primary school staffing to the extent which is necessary, in which case this is a long-term issue, but it mustn't be allowed to go away, that it ought to be possible for the world's fifth richest nation to give primary schools the range and balance of expertise which their tasks require. That's all we're arguing.
We've heard politicians talk about a broken Britain, and it's become received wisdom that childhood is in crisis. You've studied, as part of this report, the anxieties facing children. What's your view of this?
We found early on that there's huge concern about childhood, but it was a concern expressed mainly by adults on behalf of children. When we talked to children, and we talked to large numbers of children, and we actually received written submissions from children, yes, they expressed anxieties, but every generation of children does. Your generation did, my generation did. We, you know, as children, we all have our anxieties. But in fact, children are by far and away the most upbeat witnesses. It's the adults who were worried. And they were worried about things like physical safety and risk and lack of play areas, a whole range of things. But they were also worried about the pressure on children, the fact that it seems to be increasingly difficult for children just to be children. But in respect of childhood anxiety itself, we didn't find evidence that it's much, much greater than it has been. And indeed, your own newspaper published a report only the other day on adolescents, who again were happier than they're claimed to be. So we need to correct the image that has grown up. What we are clear about is that children have a right to be children before they grow up, and we want to support children and support childhood and give children just time and space to benefit from the kinds of experiences which at best characterise early childhood. However, having said all that, there is a group of children about which anxiety is merited. It's the minority who experience the double whammy of disadvantage in terms of income, in terms of housing, in terms of social conditions, in terms of familial stability, and disadvantage in terms of underachievement. And those two things map very closely onto each other. All three political parties are concerned about this. The present government has introduced, through its Children's Plan and its Narrowing the Gap programme, you know, positive measures to try and address this. Nevertheless, apropos, you know, David Cameron's comment about a broken society, Britain does remain one of the more unequal societies in the developed world. It also, and it's no coincidence, remains one of the societies in which there is one of the widest gaps between the highest and lowest attaining pupils. And clearly, if there is a crisis of childhood, that's the real crisis. That's what needs to be addressed.